Everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Our guest this week is Glenn Greenwald. Glenn is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He is also an Oscar winner, and he is a tennis fan. He's been on the podcast before, and today he talks about the new documentary that was just announced yesterday. He's doing a doc on Martina Navratilova in conjunction with Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine Studios. I will warn you, Glenn is in Brazil, where he has a base of operation with his husband and children. And this was not the cleanest conversation. Skype, you failed us. Every 5 minutes or so, the line fell out. So this is going to be a little bit choppy, but it's a good conversation with a favored guest and someone who I always look up to. He talks about the documentary with Martina. We talk a little bit about Tennis Sandgren. He has scattered thoughts there. Talk a little bit tennis. It's a good conversation in quality, meaning substance, not quality as in audio quality. So apologies. Thanks in advance to our excellent editor, Jamie Lasanti, for her editing. Good conversation. We will do it again from a cleaner line next time. Here we go. Here's Glenn Greenwald from Brazil. So I come across a headline, Glenn. It says, Martina Navratilova doc in works from Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald. And I say, those are three names, each of whom I like independently, but what are they doing in the same headline? What happened here?
I think that was the reaction of a lot of people, and actually that's what makes me probably most excited about the film, because I think it's going to subvert a lot of people's expectations about what a film like this could be, about the three of us who are collaborating on the film. And I think the extremely unlikely combination of that collaboration is kind of reflective of the extremely unlikely fact that, you know, growing up in a South Florida suburb in Reagan-era America in the early 1980s, my hero as a child and the person who influenced me most was this lesbian tennis player who had defected from Czechoslovakia. And that's what I think makes this, all of the issues raised by this film so interesting, is just kind of the unexpectedness of it. And that hopefully will get people thinking about things in ways they're not accustomed to thinking about them.
And just to be clear, this isn't scripted. This is a doc, right?
Right. So it's a documentary, but it's not at all a biography of Martina's life, right? That's like the kind of general facts of Martina's journey have been covered by books and films and articles. I think certainly tennis fans are aware of them. The general public, to a lesser extent, is as well. It's really intended to dig a lot deeper about what made Martina such a kind of singularly unique and compelling figure, not on the court, but off the court, the ways in which she influenced people around the world who aren't the likeliest people that she would end up influencing, like me, and then kind of using that as a springboard to understand things like marginalization and how we experience being ostracized as children and adolescents, what we search for in role models, the sense of possibility that people can create. So, it is a documentary, but it's not a traditional documentary in terms of let's just do a biography of Martina's life. The kind of narrative anchor is going to be, I'm meeting my childhood hero for the first time, and we're going to explore all of these issues together.
You ever hear the expression, never meet your childhood heroes? My experience with Martina has been completely the opposite, where she has she has exceeded your expectation. She's as terrific as you think she is, but I do wonder what in the 1980s made you respond to her like this. I mean, today I think she was way ahead of the times. I think history will remember her very fondly, but that wasn't necessarily the case when she's ranked number one and it's 1984. What appealed to you so much 35 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think you put your finger on it, which is that if you look at Martina through this kind of contemporary lens, you know, she seems very admirable, not even really that controversial. So I know, like, when Reese Witherspoon tweeted, Martina is this important figure for feminism and women's sports and LGBTQ equality, you know, immigrant rights, everybody says, oh, that's really noble. That's great that she did that, because those values have kind of become mainstreamed. But 25 and 30 years ago, the exact opposite was the case. Martina was an outcast because of those things. There was almost no, there was certainly very little political organization in support of those causes. There was almost no vocabulary to talk about who Martina's wife was sitting in her player's box, or who her trans coach was, Renee Richards, or the kind of musculature that Martina developed through a training regimen. So much of this was very alienating to mainstream Western culture. And for that reason, Martina was actually radioactive to sponsors. And, you know, my personal experience, I remember very well, my father, who with whom I would watch tennis, and we grew up in Fort Lauderdale, very close to where Chris Evert grew up. He was a huge Chris Evert fan. And he would constantly make these kind of very judgmental comments about Martina, contrasting her with Chris. You know, oh, look, Chris is this all-American girl from a Catholic family, and there's her boyfriend in her box, and her mom and her sister, and this great nuclear family. And then they show Martina's box, and it's filled with, you know, in his words, a bunch of dykes and just freaks. And that was how a lot of people reacted to Martina around the world. And then when she became, you know, so physically dominant as well, there was almost a sense like she was cheating. Like, this wasn't something that women should be, too strong, too, you know, athletically dominant. And as I, you know, and this is something that I really only began to explore in the last few years. I mean, I was a massive Martina fan. I mean, I was emotionally invested in her matches, you know, when I was 12 and 13 and 14. And obviously part of that was, you know, I was a gay adolescent in a time when homosexuality was almost never discussed except in connection with this fatal, horrible epidemic called AIDS. Very few celebrities were openly gay, let alone defiantly and proudly the way she was. That was part of it, but it was also when you feel kind of alienated from society, you empathize with others who are, and that was very much Martina's posture, notwithstanding that she's now widely regarded in these affectionate tones with these new eyes that we have. Very recently, you know, 25, 30 years ago, she was looked at much, much differently, and that's part of what I want the film to convey.
I think that's important, though, because I think too often this gets lost in the story that when Martina is Martina, this infrastructure doesn't exist. There is not this social moment. There is not Athletes Ally. There are not openly gay congresspeople and Will and Grace. And she's doing this at a time that's much different culturally than where we are today.
Yeah. I mean, the first conversation I had with Reese Witherspoon about this project when she had read the treatment and immediately said they want this to be their first documentary, she was talking about her own experience because she's become one of the leaders, if not the leader, of the Time's Up movement in Hollywood. She introduced Oprah Winfrey for Oprah Winfrey's, you know, really news-making Golden Globe speech. So Reese has become a political activist in addition to this kind of film mogul and A-list actress. And she talked about that, right? That we talked about that, the fact that obviously, you know, being an activist for feminism now or being an openly gay person still brings some difficulties, especially for children, but nothing compared to what it was like when Martina was doing it in the 80s when she was really alone. I mean, she became radioactive to all sponsors. She lost millions and millions of dollars by being openly gay, which WTA officials warned her would happen if she did it, and she did it anyway. But even beyond that, you know, she came here with a thick Eastern Bloc accent and often criticized the U.S. government in ways that even native-born Americans were afraid to do. So it was always this kind of defiance, always this sort of sense of I'm going to be who I am regardless of societal condemnation that made her, I think, such a powerful figure. And what really fascinates me about it is I never really have gotten the sense, and this is part of what I want to explore, that, say, unlike Billie Jean King, who I think was self-consciously a feminist activist, you know, I'm leading a movement, I'm helping a cause, I feel like Martina was more just being Martina. And one of the most fascinating quotes is when she was asked in the 70s all the time, why did you defect from Czechoslovakia? She would always say, because Czech officials told her, just don't do anything to bring attention to yourself. Don't do anything to be noticed. And she said that was basically them telling me I couldn't be an individual,
right,
which would, you know, destroy my ability to fill my potential, not only as a tennis player, but as a human being. And that, I think, is what Martina is more than anything, is just this person who insisted on the right to express herself as an individual. And it cut across, you know, sexual orientation lines and gender lines and cultural lines and nationality in a way that I don't think people have quite appreciated. And I also think it's exactly what you just said, which is we often so take for granted the idea that you can stand up and say, I'm going to be a feminist, or I'm going to be, you know, a gay activist, or I'm going to be an immigrant exercising my political rights, whereas 30 years ago, that really did bring you amazing scorn. And to go and to listen to, you know, TV announcers, the way overwhelmingly male TV announcers at Wimbledon finals talked about Martina, or male sports writers wrote about her body, it's actually shocking. And I want people to know what the discourse was so recently, who might, especially younger generations, take for granted a lot of the liberties we now have.
I stumbled across, totally by accident, within the last week, a write-up of the 1984 Wimbledon, when Martina won and showed up with, I'm blanking on the, Judy Nelson for the first time. These are not the British tabs, never mind that. I mean, the regular, austere, esteemed British publications were had no idea how to characterize any of this. But these stories that were written about Martina and her lover's box and the terminology that was sort of thrown around cavalierly, it's really remarkable. I don't know if how deeply you've delved into that, but Wimbledon 1984, that might help you in your research. Is Martina, I mean, I assume this is with her blessing and her full cooperation and support?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I said, a big part of the film is going to be, I purposely have avoided meeting Martina the last couple of years because I wanted to preserve, you know, the substance of our interaction for the film. So the big kind of narrative anchor of the film is going to be the lead up and the preparation to my going to her house and or wherever we meet and meeting her for the first time and then however much time we spend together. So yeah, she's excited by it. She's supportive of it. She is cooperative with it, especially when she found out that, you know, somebody like Reese Witherspoon was so vocally behind it. That made her more excited still. So I think it has the potential to have a real impact, not just with tennis audiences, because I don't see it as a tennis film or even a sports film, but as a broad mainstream cultural film that will resonate in lots of different countries. And that's why that unlikely combination that you started off alluding to is so important, you know, and it's so exciting in terms of the potential that I think the film could have.
But just to be clear, you're a tennis guy. I mean, I want to sell your bona fides. You appreciate when a player wins five majors in a row and Martina's achievements. Were you a player? Were you a junior player? I mean, were you appreciating her as an athlete in the 80s as well?
Oh yeah, I mean, I did your show a couple of years ago in the run up to the Olympics here in Rio, and we spent a long time talking about the current state of tennis. So I've been, you know, a tennis fanatic just as an admirer of the game and the sport for so long. And that was, you know, obviously the foundation for my admiration for Martina. My connection to Martina would be sitting in front of the TV watching her play, usually Chris Evert, but, you know, Steffi Graf and Monica Seles and Pam Shriver and Zina Garrison and just all the Hanna Monlikova and Jana Novotna. You know, that whole era is what really transformed me into a fanatic of the sport.
Random one for you. Did you listen to Slow Burn, that Slate Watergate podcast?
I have not, no.
It's terrific. Highly recommend. But the point is that it's a podcast, I think it's seven or eight part podcast about Watergate, but obviously the resonances today are a big reason of why this is important and why it's greenlit. This documentary on Martina is not existing in a vacuum. How much does this dovetail with this peculiar cultural moment we're having right now?
Oh yeah, I think in so many ways it does. You know, part of it is the good part of a cultural moment, right? Like I was really struck by the fact that the stars of the Winter Olympics were Adam Rippon and Gus Kenworthy, not despite their being gay, but because of it. You know, Gus Kenworthy kissing his boyfriend on national television, and Adam Rippon, you know, just being very kind of aggressively gay about his identity in so many ways that won them great admiration. You know, tennis players now come out not so much on the ATP circuit still, but in fact, not at all for active players, but the WTA, I think in the last 12 months, something like six or seven top 100 players have come out, and it barely causes a ripple. And so the contrast is, I think, very exciting. And then you have the kind of darker side of our political reality, right? That, you know, one of the things that I think makes Martina so remarkable is that she came to the United States often in times where immigrants weren't appreciated. She came during the Reagan era, which was a high level of patriotism and criticized the government. She created this massive controversy right after the 9/11 attack. In like February of 2002, she gave an interview to a German paper where she said the Bush administration was destroying the political rights that she came to the United States to enjoy. It caused a huge controversy. Connie Chung interviewed her and told her, you know, something like, who are you to criticize our country? If you don't like it here, why don't you go back to Czechoslovakia? And so, you know, there's this amazing moment now where you see celebrities and especially sports figures using their platform for the political rights that they correctly perceived are being under attack by our own government. And Martina was a pioneer of that too, of the idea that, yes, I'm a tennis player, but I'm not going to be Michael Jordan, who is just going to remain apolitical and silent because I want to represent Nike and Coca-Cola and get rich off doing that. I'm also a human being involved in this culture, and I'm going to use my political rights. And you see that now with athletes and celebrities who realize that, you know, we're kind of in a political moment where nobody has the luxury of thinking they're outside of or above politics. And that's certainly true of immigrants, people who come to the United States in search of a better life, as Martina did. So, yeah, I think that it resonates in so many ways more now than ever because of the climate the United States is currently in politically.
As long as you brought it up, this is a question that people are often curious about. Any thoughts on why there are no out gay men on the ATP Tour and really never have been during their playing career? I mean, it doesn't. We certainly have an analog and a long history on the women's side. It doesn't strike me as a particularly hostile workplace. It's an individual sport. You're not dependent on the coach finding favor with the coach or, you know, the quarterback throwing you the ball. Any idea why that hasn't been the case, just empirically?
It's so baffling and counterintuitive for exactly the reason that you just said. So you have, in team sports, where you could almost understand the reluctance because of the need to have camaraderie with people who may not be comfortable, openly gay athletes, you know, in the most kind of like macho, traditional male sport, football, basketball, you know, baseball. And yet in tennis, where no camaraderie is needed with anybody but your own team, and there are lots of players, Maria Sharapova most famously, who go out of their way not to have any interaction with anyone who's on the tour because of how individually competitive it is, and yet it's never happened. And I listened to your really fascinating interview with Brian Vahaly, who I think is probably still one of the only contemporary top 100 players who came out even after retirement. You know, and he sort of talked about, in a way that was interesting, but also a little bit excuse-making, kind of, look, my focus was on my tennis. I didn't want to distract from it by being the gay tennis player. I think he had a little bit of regret, but, you know, I think that what ends up happening is that tennis players are kind of trained to be so obsessively focused on themselves and their athletic success that, you know, even now coming out is still a difficult thing to do, especially if you're in the public eye, that I think that it just ends up being something that distracts from what they're supposed to be focused on, but that still leaves the question of why women players can do it and not male players. And I think the answer to that is there always has been a different kind of stigma on gay men than on gay women. Not to say one is more or less, but they're just kind of different in how they manifest, and I think that's part of what explains that.
I'll give you a floater that you can hit over the fence, but it was suggested to me that one reason is that there is something self-selecting going on, and that just empirically speaking, gay men are not playing professional tennis, and they're just... So someone said, isn't it possible that there are no gay men in the top 100? And all of this is not about social stigma and history and fears, but just that player does not exist. You want to Going to have it that one?
You know, I suppose it is possible. I think there, I'm not entirely sure, but I think there are some lower ranked players that have come out, though very few. So, but even there, so there are what now, 1,700 ranked players in the ATA, in the ATP rankings,
right,
from, you know, dozens and dozens of different countries and backgrounds. It would be extremely hard for me to believe that the primary reason that there are just no prominent current active players who are openly gay is because none of them is gay. I suppose it's possible. But given that we have now openly gay athletes in every other sport, it's hard for me to see why gay men would be particularly avoiding tennis. You know, especially since the choice of what sport we commit to happens, you know, if you're a professional when you're 8 or 9 or 10, before we even have self-consciousness about this. So I think, you know, obviously it's possible that that's the case, but I think that that explanation, especially when you look back 10 and 20 years, becomes increasingly unlikely.
From a math perspective, it doesn't make sense. All right, here's a nerdy X's and O's documentary question. I hope I'm not violating confidences, but I'm wrapping up a Federer-Nadal documentary that we're trying to have out this summer, and getting rights to tennis matches is not for the faint of heart. Have you thought about how you are going to get the actual footage of Martina playing?
You mean the footage from her old matches?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, there's all different, as you have written about, you know, part of what makes tennis so difficult is that there's just so many little fiefdoms and factions, and so, you know, each Grand Slam footage is controlled by one entity, and then the WTA tournaments are controlled by others. It's going to be a big headache, but at the same time, Martina has a lot of it. A lot of it is online where you can use it as fair use. And so I think we're going to try and make liberal use of those fair use laws so that we don't have to end up licensing things from 1,000 different very authoritarian entities.
If only you were a lawyer. Let me. I was going to say
that background might come in handy.
We should pause here and say the JD Oscar winner, Pulitzer Prize winner is a trifecta on the order of Greenwald, Navratilova, and Reese Witherspoon. You don't often see JD Oscar and Pulitzer Prize winner in the same bio. So I pause to commend you for that.
It's exciting.
So I don't want to violate confidences, but I know that the two of us have both had some fairly lengthy exchanges with Tennis Sandgren post Australia, and I wanted to just kind of get your take. This is not a feud, and I don't think this is even a situation that sort of breaks along left right conservative liberal divide lines. It's a weird sort of fact pattern here, but I'm curious what you make of this in general, and maybe the social media dimension to this whole saga.
Well, I found the whole controversy that kind of escalated with each match that tennis won at the Australian Open to be really fascinating. And in part, it was because it began by kind of this this reaction to the people that he was following on Twitter. He wasn't following all that many people, I think maybe like 500. And among them were a bunch of very controversial and, in my view, very pernicious kind of figures from what people often refer to as the alt-right. And as it turned out, he also, though, and this made it into almost none of the stories, also followed a lot of people who are typically associated with the left, one of whom happened to be me.
Exactly.
And he also followed The Intercept, which is the media organization I co-founded in 2013 and where I currently report. And so the storyline and the narrative that got formed with each kind of passing victory as he progressed through the tournament was that he was kind of this hardened racist who had associated himself with some very odious political causes and figures and ideologies. And, you know, one of the things that I personally think has happened over the past, you know, say 2 years is that as we tried to understand how Donald Trump won the presidency, and despite all the ways he deviates from what we think of a president is supposed to be and the expectations that he would lose, we've kind of taken the entire group of people who voted for him and have just kind of written them off as these kind of retrograde racists.
Deplorables.
In Hillary Clinton's words, deplorables. And I think that, you know, a lot of them are and a lot of them aren't. A huge number of them are not, in fact. A lot of them voted for Obama and then voted for Trump because they were looking for somebody to oppose the current political climate that has been so damaging economically to so many people, created all this inequality. They were just looking for somebody who railed against how things are done in Washington, the way first Obama did and then Trump did. So I never thought, you know, I've always been uncomfortable with this narrative that anyone who votes for Trump, who voted for Trump, is this sort of just retrograde fascist or racist, the way that I think that in a lot of ways this narrative around Tennis Sandgren formed. And then I'm also just very wary as well, as somebody who does a lot of work online and is pretty active on social media and in a way in a world that's very polarizing and divisive, which is the world of politics and journalism, of how easy it is to form judgments about people based on kind of stray tweets that people haven't thought out very clearly or might be, you know, posting, running toward dinner or whatever. And I've seen lots of people that I know really well be radically misportrayed about who they really are based on a lot of this. And so when this whole thing with Dennis happened, I was very curious to know, is he really this, you know, kind of hardcore, irredeemable, racist and, you know, somebody who empathizes with fascism the way that it was being suggested? Or is he somebody more kind of thoughtful and open and who is being unfairly vilified? And so I ended up talking to him as a result of the fact that he followed me on Twitter. He, by chance, actually, I live in Rio de Janeiro, of course, and he did after the Australian Open, a Latin America clay court swing that included, there's a big ATP 500 tournament here in Rio de Janeiro, that he played in. And so, you know, he met my husband, who's a black elected socialist here in Rio, and our recently adopted children from the northeastern part of Brazil. And we spent time together. And I've gotten to know him pretty well, and he's an extremely smart, thoughtful, open-minded person who I think wasn't so much attracted to, you know, this kind of ugly part of an ideology, but is really just somebody who at the age of 25 and 26 is looking for answers, figuring out who he is, trying to navigate through different ways of looking at the world. And, you know, we have to accept the fact that trust in our big media institutions have collapsed and people therefore are more open-minded to alternative sources of information. And, you know, honestly, John, one of the things for which I'm most grateful in life is that the internet did not exist when I was 18 and 20 and 25 to permanently record all of the thoughts that I felt like expressing in the world.
What about this? When you're homeschooled,
we rebel against things, when we, you know, figure out what taboos we can violate, when we're figuring out who we want to be as people. And so I think to take tweets that somebody wrote when they were ranked 600 in the world and nobody was paying attention to, and they had 30 followers and they were focused on their tennis and not politics, and use it to kind of permanently erect this very negative image of who they are, in this way that felt like kind of mob justice, you know, picking on somebody who, unlike, say, Ryan Harrison or John Isner or Sam Querrey, who have been around for tennis a long time and also have a lot of pro-Trump sentiments that they've expressed, somebody who was just very easy to pick on because he had no prize money, he wasn't represented by IMG, you know, and it just started to feel like a kind of mob mentality, demonizing and villainizing somebody a little unfairly. And so the more I got to know him, the more I became convinced that's true. You know, I'm glad he deleted his tweets. I'm glad that he apologized for some of the ones that were the most offensive, many of which were written when he was 19 and 20 years old. And I think he is somebody who has learned a lot from that, and hopefully people will give him a second chance the way they should give everybody a chance to kind of redeem things they've said or done in the past.
One of the ironies, and I think you and I are very much at the same place here, one of the ironies I found was that here is someone who has more sort of curiosity and philosophical flexibility than anyone. Here's someone who openly admits he's still trying to figure out issues and figure out where he stands. He was homeschooled, so he probably maybe come to this process a little bit late. In some ways, we should all envy his open-mindedness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very fair when a public figure or somebody who becomes a public figure has said certain things or expressed certain views that are disturbing or, that it have some underlying ugly sentiments, to hold those people accountable for those things and to ask about them. And to inquire, is this really something that you believe? Is this really who you are? And in that case, and in so many other cases that we've seen where people have had their reputations destroyed overnight because of a single tweet, sometimes the ones that they intended to post but was poorly thought out, other times ones that were misunderstood, the power of social media to bring us all together and to exert this power to build up people or destroy them is an extremely potent one. There's a reason why we don't punish people in societies judicially and without there being a real process to kind of examine the evidence and give everybody an opportunity to be heard, because humans are so prone to making errors in judgment. But on social media, there are none of those protections. It's very easy to just kind of instantly react and condemn and denounce. And I think we need to be a lot more careful about this new medium and the power that it wields to venerate people when they don't deserve it, but also to turn them into demons as well.
I heard a law professor say this is the first time in history people are punished for ideas. All right, this before our audio goes, a little speed round for you if you're up for it.
Sure, let's go.
Thiago Monteiro is the highest-ranking Brazilian. What's going on with Brazilian tennis?
Brazilian tennis is really sad. There's so many talented players, Thomas Bellucci being kind of the symbol, Thiago Monteiro being another, that just aren't reaching their potential for whatever reason. And it's a country primed to love tennis. It's the fifth biggest country in the world. Because of Guga, they are ready to embrace tennis, and yet the next generation just hasn't come close for reasons that are really hard to understand.
All right, in 60 seconds or less, and we could do an hour on this, when you're at a cocktail party and people say, what is the state of the First Amendment these days? What are your top-line thoughts?
The First Amendment is something that I am actually a pretty strong proponent of in a pretty absolute sense. I kind of agree with the ACLU's view of free speech. They've obviously represented some of the worst human beings on the planet in terms of their free speech right, which is what I've done too, both as a journalist and a lawyer. So I think it's under attack in lots of different ways. Unfortunately, not the ways that we often appreciate. The people, for example, on college campuses who are most punished for their speech tend to be people who criticize Israel or who are activists on behalf of Palestinian rights. A lot of the censorship comes from the right. A lot comes from the left. And I think we got to have the attitude that free debate is always better than picking and choosing which ideas are not allowed to be expressed.
What's your status update, if in a minute or less? We spoke 2 years ago about the sort of the state of Brazil. Two years later, You run into someone sits next to you on a plane and says, what's the deal with Brazil? What's your top line response to that?
Things have gotten actually worse since we spoke, and they were pretty bad back then. There's a presidential election in 2018. The candidate that was leading in the polls, which was Lula, who was the president for 8 years, is now in prison. Faith in the entire media and political establishment have collapsed, which, as we've seen in the UK and the US, opens the way for demagogues and extremists. And the leading candidate is an actual fascist, somebody who wants a restoration of a military dictatorship. It's a really grim situation in Brazil, but there's, as always, opportunities for good things as well when crises emerge.
Last question. What's your timetable for this documentary? I suspect this will excite a lot of people, and the first question they will say is, when is it coming out? What do you tell people?
So the standard conventional view of documentaries is that it's supposed to take 12 to 18 months. I have a lot less patience than that, so I'm saying it's going to be done in nine months or so, but probably it'll be a year from the time we start, which is now, until the time that it's actually ready to be seen. So I would say probably early 2019, so basically a year from now.
I'm thinking this will excite a lot of fans. This was a form of torture, having to cut this apart. Next time we will talk Dilma Rousseff and more tennis, and we will do it without all these interruptions. How's that sound?
Yeah, we will definitely secure a better line. I'd love to do it.
Thanks so much. Good luck with the doc. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, John. Really, really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Glenn. All right. Thanks to our guest, Glenn Greenwald. Thanks, as always, to Jamie Lasanti, who has her work cut out for her on this podcast, patching together all that dicey audio here in our studio in New York to Brazil. But we thank Glenn. We look forward to that Martina Navratilova documentary. If any tennis subject warrants a documentary, it's Martina. This seems like a great way to approach her and all she stands for. Jamie, bring you in. Again, that was a little dicey audio-wise, but it more than compensated with substance. Always a pleasure talking with Glenn Greenwald.
We're going to make some calls to Skype after this one.
Damn you, Skype. What struck you from that conversation?
I really enjoyed his discussion about Tennis Sandgren and sort of how they connected and how he was able to meet with him and spend time with him and talk with him. It's a nice perspective. Of course, all of us don't have that luxury of kind of spending time with him and getting to know him, which of course can kind of help the whole situation. But I really appreciated his insight from those conversations and the takeaways that he had from them. So
I think it's going to be interesting to see where Tennis Sandgren goes from here. This was all private, so I'm not comfortable sharing, but we had a number of long exchanges, and I think Tennis Sandgren is not what I suspect the casual fan might think he is. This is someone who's very thoughtful, very open-minded. I think he's a little bit still baffled and maybe shell-shocked about what happened. This is not someone who's drawn his political line in the stand and, you know, if I'm following who I follow, and if you don't like it, don't come into my tent. It's a perception reality thing. I think it's going to be interesting how Tennis Sandgren handles this. Do you try and sort of rewrite the narrative, or does he feel so burned that I'm just going to make it all about tennis and I'm not going near that third rail that is politics in the U.S. in 2018?
If and when he kind of advances far again and kind of really starts to make a name tennis-wise, it will be interesting to see if he defers those kind of questions, because it will undoubtedly come up again, or, we'll see how people react. I think it will linger for at least this year. I think it's still too soon.
Yeah, I think you have a good point, too, that the state of his tennis, and again, if anything good came out of this, it's that we no longer have to make gratuitous jokes about his name being tennis. But if the state of his play and the state of his ranking continues to improve, that gives him more opportunity to be a public figure. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how he handles this, because this is not someone who has extreme views necessarily and has drawn his line in the sand. I can make a small announcement here, Jamie, I think. I'm not sure if this is appropriate, but we'll do it anyway since we're talking about tennis documentaries. I think we're at the point where we can officially say that a Federer-Nadal documentary will be released here in a few weeks. This has been a bit of a secret, a bit on the down low, as it were. But I think we're at a place where I'm going to take the liberty of telling tennis fans that's something they can look forward to. We'll leave it at that and have more details coming. But as long as we're talking about documentaries, I figure this is as good a time as any.
I won't pry.
Don't pry.
No.
I mean, this project has been in the... It's based on the book I wrote 10 years ago. I did not think when I wrote about their 2008 Wimbledon match 10 years ago, they would still be number one and number two in the world, and having won every major played in the last 18 months. But here we are 10 years later, which again, I mean, this, it's about their rivalry. It's about this amazing match they had at Wimbledon, sort of a love letter to both players. Tennis Channel will be broadcasting it along with some other partners. But I think we can make that announcement. I'm not on the PR team, but we're a few weeks away, and maybe it's time to get the publicity wheels rotating. Did you happen to see Karolina Pliskova yesterday, Jamie Lasanti?
Yes.
I'm putting you on the spot. You saw that one. Thoughts?
Oh, I mean...
Punishment?
She got angry.
She did get angry.
I think maybe first time we've seen something like that from her. I was going to say not from a player in general, but I can't recall a time where she's really gotten so mad at her.
But I think she's a player who you suspect, she's top five player and probably has some competitive instincts. But no, I've never seen anything like that.
I mean, generally, you say that top five player, there probably should be some sort of repercussion, just kind of as a principle type thing.
I've got two kind of, I don't know. Tell me if you agree on this. I mean, I have two countervailing forces here. One of them, three really. One of them is, again, I distinguish between heat of battle and when our biochemistry is back to normal. You know, have a dispute in the locker room or the players' lounge. That to me is exponentially worse than when we're in this aroused state of competition. She also did get the raw end of a deal. We can discussion for another time. Why is there not Hawkeye on Clay, Jamie Lasanti? Right. I ask you. I mean, you know what? Not unlike Jared Donaldson, I do think there's something to be said for the fact that she was wronged. The countervailing point in the other direction is you don't do that to an official.
Right. Well, that's what my thing is, that the principle is that, you know, she's a top five player. Yes, the call was wrong, but, you know, the call could have happened to other people. So you wouldn't expect, you don't want anyone else to react that way. So it's kind of like if you let someone else do it and you don't punish them.
Not a good look. But no, I just think it's one of the ground rules of sports. We see this in the NBA all the time. You can say whatever you want. The minute you make physical contact with an official, you've surrendered the boarding pass.
Even if it's just a little get in the face.
Exactly. This will only add to the wide openness of the women's draw. We'll do a little French Open preview next week. But real quick, today.
Yes.
May 17th. Okay. Pick your French Open women's winner.
Oh, Simona Halep.
All right. Not bad.
Finalist
last year. Can you give me one more week?
That's not
I don't
fair.
Know. Every time you check these results, you're like, oh, it's Mugu. And then you're, Mugu's out.
Now. We can change it next
week.
Yeah,
I'd probably go Halep. Okay. I probably would.
All right.
Kind of a lame pick, but anyway.
I have a random question.
What do you got?
You.
What do you got?
I don't know if I've ever asked you this. What is your opinion on, I don't really know if I see this in any other sports. It always is funny to me. Players, when they have to withdraw from a tournament or, you know, they play a match and they get injured, they send out a tweet and it's like, I'm so sorry that I had to withdraw. Here's the reason why. I'm looking forward to coming back, or I'm looking forward to being here next year. Is it necessary? I mean, we don't see that. If Cam Newton has to sit out on a Sunday, he's not sending out a tweet saying, sorry, Panthers fans, you know, I'm not playing this week and I'm really bummed about it. You know, they just kind of, the team issues an injury report and you.
That's the key right there, though.
No,
Cam Newton has the apparatus of a team.
But the tournament announces The tournament will say, you know, so-and-so has withdrawn because of a knee injury and, you know, they won't be competing this year.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that is for their fans at the event. Hey, listen, I've traveled great lengths to see Madison Keys play in Italy. How could she have done this for me? I think it's probably more for the global fan base that these players have. I'm with you, though.
I just feel like there's a weird standard set
It's a little weird.
If I was a player, I would feel almost obligated to do it because my colleagues essentially are also doing it. And so maybe I really hurt myself and like I don't think that I need to announce it.
But I don't
apologize.
Is it the apology? Is it the precedent? Is it the fact that prior to a Grand Slam we always see a lot of withdrawals because players want to go in as close to 100%?
I think it's the apology part. Don't be sorry for, I mean, because then you see the I'm sorry I had to withdraw. And the reason is because of an injury, but sometimes it's because they just won the previous tournament and, you know, they need a week off. And so it's like, should you really be apologizing for that?
It's sort of an offshoot of that. The cognate of that is the tournament that says, we are so sorry that Jamie Lasanti won't be playing this event. Meanwhile, they're grinding their teeth and they're trying to get their appearance fee back and, but it also says, you know, we wish her nothing but the best. We look forward to her return to Montreal in 2019. She's a decorated champion, and it's a pity she won't be with us, but she's been a great ambassador. And meanwhile, you know they're, ugh. Strange twist in tennis, one of many. But no, I do think as the Grand Slams get more and more important in every sense, in the prize money goes up, and this is where players make their reputations, it's a real risk you run at these tune-up events that if I'm trying to win the French Open and I'm a little dinged up 10 days out in Rome, that fourth round match becomes very losable on my schedule. So you're never quite sure the severity of these. I mean, you know, you saw something like, you saw the Bryan brothers. I think Bob hurt his, looked like he hurt his hip, pulling out of a final. That's a legitimate injury. A lot of other times you think this may be more precautionary. But, you know, again, we're in a sport of independent contractors. There is no Carolina Panthers that can put you on the list.
I knew that
so
was going to be your
The players are autonomous beings. Anyway, good question. You can feel free to ask me anything. Thanks to Glenn Greenwald again. And again, apologies for that audio. But the takeaway, the cut and save is that this Martina Navratilova documentary might be out if I heard right, as soon as early 2019. I'm not sure if he misspoke there, but that would be great. Glenn does terrific work. You can follow him on Twitter, G. Greenwald. You can see his work on The Intercept. And again, this is an A-list journalist. The rare journalist, Jamie Lasanti, if you said Brady Manning to him, he would say Chelsea Manning and a Brady declaration, a Brady disclosure. Different kind of guest. Next week, we will talk pre-French Open. We have a guest TBD, but we will call out Lindsay Davenport and say we're expecting her to sign up again, as she usually does before the French Open. Jamie, thanks. Where can people listen to this podcast if they're so inclined?
Yeah, so I'm going to leave specific instructions this week on how to leave a review.
You were chastised last week.
Yeah, so maybe not everyone listens to podcasts on their iPhone or with the Apple Podcast app, but I think it's a real thing. It's purple. If you don't know it, okay? And so you go there and you search for Beyond the Baseline. And when you get there, there's like little tabs. So one of them is, you know, John's doing this right now. You can go and search, and one of them is details, and then the middle one is reviews. And then when you click reviews, you can write one. And you can rate it and write it all in one, and then you hit send, and it goes.
Presto. All right. With that directive in mind, Beyond the Baseline is the name of the podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Keep the suggestions coming. A lot of good guest suggestions came in the last few days. We'll do it again next week. Thanks for listening. Have a good week, everyone.